This is the First Time Podcast,
where we talk writing, publishing, and all of the feels.
It's conversations between us
and conversations with Australian and international authors about their craft, their books, and the writing life. I'm Kate Mildenhall.
And I'm Catherine Collette. Welcome to the First Time Podcast, Season 6. This podcast was recorded and produced on the unceded lands of the Wurundjeri and Wurrung people of the Kulin Nation. We pay our respects to their elders past and present and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander cultures.
Today's episode is a very special feature brought to you by Penguin Books, in which we speak to four different debut authors. Penguin Books' Year of Fresh Voices campaign shines a spotlight on their amazing debut authors, and we're thrilled to have the opportunity to speak to four of those authors, Erin Riley, Vidya Matabushi, Annette Higgs, and Nick Bassine. Enjoy the episode. To kick off our special debut feature episode from Penguin Books, I'm very excited to be talking to Erin Riley about their debut collection, A Real Piece of Work. Erin is a writer and social worker who has spent most of the last decade working alongside marginalised populations in community aged care in and around Sydney. Erin brings a queer lived experience to their professional work and to their writing. They were a Penguin Random House Australia Write-It Fellow in 2021 and have been published in various publications, including Kill Your Darlings and Bent Street. Erin lives in Sydney with their partner and Remy, the dog. Yeah. A Real Piece of Work is their debut book. Welcome, Erin. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me, Kate. It's such a pleasure. I'm so grateful. I've been listening to your show for such a long time. I've loved it. And it's kind of wild to think, oh, wow, one day I'll be speaking on it because I've written a book. Because I think I was just fascinated with writing when I first listened to your show. I was not actually doing any writing.
Gives us such a buzz when we have people who come on and talk about their debut books and they're like, I've been listening. It's like joy bombs, absolute joy bombs.
It's a beautiful thing to do for the world of writing. Like, it's really a generous offering.
Can you please give us the pitch for your debut collection, A Real Piece of Work?
It's a strange collection of essays. But I think when you loosely read it, it's, you know, it's a memoir about sort of growing into yourself. It's a memoir about outsiders. I think it's a story that centers outsiders. It's a book that is a memoir, but it's odd because it doesn't center the person who it's about. I think you kind of get to know me through the stories of other people. And I think in some ways, because of my work as a social worker, a lot of connections are relational. So we get to know each other and ourselves and our position in the world in connection with other people. And in some ways, I think also it's about structures that create marginalization and sustain it. And I think because of my work, I can't talk directly to some of the people that I work with, some of the structures that harm them. And I've always wanted to do that. But in some ways, I kind of illuminate these structures through kind of talking about my own story. So I think it's a book about structures and stories. It's about the stories that we tell ourselves about who we are. And also, I guess, the stories that limit us and how we can kind of get curious about them. But, yeah, it's a memoir and essays that's kind of trying to centre people who haven't been centred before or who don't get centred much.
I did have to message you immediately when I finished reading it because it is an extraordinarily compelling piece of work. And I think, yes, there are so many threads, despite the vast topics that you cover, because there is your work as a social worker. There's this idea, that beautiful phrase of the kind of growing into transness, two of the big topics, but then there's also swimming and there's dating and heartbreak and there's OCD and there's the writers who inspire you. So can you tell us perhaps where you began in the writing of these stories? What came first?
I was reading in lockdown. I was reading amazing things. And I used to think I read really fast. And I see all these Instagram people who are just like breakneck speed writers. And I think, gosh, 50 books a year, I'm pretty happy with if I can read 50 books a year. But I was reading like Deborah Levy, and I was reading Olivia Lang, and I was reading Fiona Wright and Alexander Chee and all these beautiful writers. And I was just really having a nice time. And I was really inspired to do some writing. I was like, this is a nervous system experience. I feel really lovely. And it was because the world was falling apart and I had time. But I just went to a writer's class. Meryn bought me a writer's class for my birthday, and I went to like a fortnight writing school class over about a month with the poet Mark Trebnick, and I just wrote some stories and I loved it. And so I just kind of had a bit more time on my hands. I was working part-time, started writing whatever came to mind. And for a long time, I'd been wanting to write about my work, but in a way that was not like, or an academic journal was not. I didn't want to just write for social workers because I was like, everyone knows this stuff, you know. It was almost like, I think I said something to someone, I want to write something that someone in the Good Weekend could read, you know, like that was accessible. And so, I kind of just started writing the stuff that mattered to me about my work in a more, I guess, narrative style. I was like, the reason we connect with people's stories or with problems in the world is through understanding someone's experience, you know, through narrative, you know. I guess that's kind of where the rest of this book kind of came from, is like, oh, the narrative of me is going to maybe humanize some of these experiences for people. I had this beautiful academic who literally threw my work back at me and he's like, this is the paper we're going to write. And I just didn't do anything with it, just sort of walked around with this, you know, empty precy of an academic paper on the piece that actually became Patrick. And then years later, sort of dovetailed into something very different. But yeah, the pieces were just, they just wrote themselves kind of in lockdown. And then I put them in a spreadsheet because I had a whole bunch of sex worker friends who were all out of work and I just felt pretty hopeless. And so I was like, does anyone want to buy my stories on the internet? And people donated and I made $400 and people wrote to me like, I really like those stories. You should keep doing it.
It feels like they have naturally kind of found their form. Like your voice holds through. It's one of those threads. It's so steady and it's so easy to read. And yeah. I talked about this with Catherine on one of the episodes, that it's also so generous that you offer so many insights and this kind of intimate view of these lives and your life. That is one of the threads that holds us through. What was it like, Erin, as you shifted your focus from writing about the people that you were working with to turning that on yourself? Was that a different kind of experience of writing?
It's really generous, actually. Thank you, Kay, for saying those things. It's really nice to know that voice does travel through because, you know, the craft of writing is so new to me, you know, and I think that's what's really interesting about me as a writer, is that it is a very new thing. So my understanding and ability to talk about craft is somewhat limited, I think, which is fine. And I think that's the nice, authentic thing I can bring to whatever happens with this book. But I think I've been thinking about myself for a long time outside of writing about it. I think my work has helped me a lot to understand the patterns in my life that needed to change. And some of the things I was doing that were just looking after everyone else. You know, I was looking after everyone else in my work, but looking after my family's feelings a lot. And I recognized that was a pattern a long time ago. So I think in some ways this was just me actually really reckoning with it on the page. But writing about myself has, I think, been really healing. And I think some people I think I listen to who say, you know, writing isn't therapy. And it can be. I think if you read this book from beginning to end, you see a shift. Like there is a real shift in, I think that's what's really quite interesting about it, is that there's lots of ways you kind of follow me from the beginning when I really don't think I deserve a lot. Like that really, that initial story was very accidental. Like I'd written the book and Maren's my partner, was like, you should put the wedding story, like the daughter's story at the beginning of the book. Like it would make a really nice bookend to this collection. And it does, because there's this huge movement where I'm like not even kind of understanding myself properly, but not even allowing myself to be cared for in the way that I needed to be cared for by my family, you know, which is interesting. But I'm really proud of it. I feel like the book has gifted me something. Like I don't know what would have happened if I hadn't got that fellowship, whether or not I would have dug and thought about some of those things in the same way that I have had to for the book. Yeah.
Let's talk about those people who helped Erin and this idea of the fellowship, because it's a beautiful story, the fact that there was this kind of number of birthday gifts from Erin, from your partner, then these other kind of mentors and teachers who came into your life along this journey, and then the fellowship. Can you just talk a little bit about the kind of key moments in there? Because writers love to hear a path to publication story.
Anna Spargo Ryan, she probably wouldn't remember this, but she accepted one of my stories for Island Magazine, I think, like 2 years ago. I think it was the one that turned into a real piece of work. And she basically said, this is a great story, but take yourself out of it, or take some part of yourself out of it. And it was great advice. And I think she wanted to publish it. I don't know what happened. It didn't get published, but like it was one of the first times. And I was like, it was such great advice. Mm. I sent a few things into magazines, got really kind, personalized rejections. And I felt so fine. I was like, this is awesome. Like, and I think maybe it was you both, you and Catherine, talking about rejections can be great. Like, especially when people give them personalized feedback to you. And it's not just a thanks for your time. So I did a lot of like just submitting stuff. I got really interested writing stuff, throwing them into the world. Mm. And I was like, well, I haven't been writing for long. So like, what do I expect? You know, it's so fine. This is just me practicing and having stuff to kind of aim for. Fiona Wright helped me edit one of my first stories. So that was one of Meryn's next birthday presents, was like this kind of mentoring a couple of hours with Fiona. The next year was a headshot. So I'm so grateful because I
love this.
It was actually for work. It was like, this is for work, but like also maybe if you ever write and need one. So this, I feel like all of these beautiful gifts have kind of almost like foreshadowing this nice thing that's going to happen if you believe in magic or whatever. But so that was kind of it's just lots of people being really generous with their energy. And also I guess my own like dedication to trying and practicing. Yeah. And then I threw all 7,000 words I'd ever written to Penguin for this fellowship. I think I stumbled on it the day before. Like, I think it was really close, really close. And I think I sent three of the very drafty versions of the stories in this book. And I thought, no chance. Like, I just didn't think it was good enough. And I got onto the long list, and then I got onto the short list. And I was so pumped. I was like, I don't even care what happens next. Like, I can say I've been shortlisted for a prize, that's awesome, because I know how helpful that can be. And then when I got the mentorship, that was a really beautiful moment as well. That was enough, you know, just a year of doing beautiful things with Clive, my editor. And then, that was kind of the progression to the fellowship, which then led to the book.
One of the things that I love so much in reading the collection is this, the swimming and the that idea of you in COVID, and getting those exercise bikes, like trying to find this routine, you know, trying to get it back again. What have you brought from those other aspects of your life to this idea of it's okay if I submit and nothing comes back? Are there qualities that you've brought from those other parts of your life that you can kind of articulate? And in terms of being able to keep picking yourself up when you're not, you know, you're not getting big wins on the board with your publication stuff yet?
Oh, look, I think... And it's interesting because I think that my life is so much more than my writing, and it always has been. So this is this beautiful, I see this as just a beautiful lucky accident that's happened to me. It's really interesting because I do think that I have a bit of an internal voice that's like very small, you're not good enough, but I think that I'm really conquering that. So I do think I'm just like, how awesome, this great thing has happened to me. My writing is good. You know, I like it. If it goes into the world and no one hates it, that's okay. Like I've got some beautiful people around me who I really respect, who have said some really nice things about it, and that is it for me. Like, I'm so grateful for that. But I think because it was never a really big dream, I was like, I didn't have dreams to be crushed because I didn't, you know, like I was like, I like writing. I'd love for it to be a thing for me. But like, you know, I'm really good at my job and that's my craft, you know. My craft is like rapport building and being with people in the messy, you know, throes of their day-to-day, you know, and that's... So I think that helps. That just balances it because that's so much of who I am. And maybe also not being defined by this idea of like your value is what you produce, you know, and I want to be careful about that with this book, you know, like, and I guess that's what the stories of this book's about. Like I can't then go, oh, my book's bad, I'm going to crumple inside, you know, like people don't like it. Go for it. That's fine. That's so reasonable, you know.
There's such a healthy approach to have, Erin. I love that. I feel like you just need to give us all a pep talk every time we're about to put things out into the world. Often in conversations that I have with writers, both for the podcast and off air, we talk about that fraught nature of writing the self and of writing memoir, particularly where it involves other people. And I was really moved and interested in your author's note. And I've checked that it's okay to read back with you. You're reflecting at the end of the book on the fact that there has been an element of repair in a particular relationship with your family. And you go on to write, Knowing that I am a fully fledged, reflective, lovable adult, no longer small and vulnerable, I have changed nothing because this is what happened and these stories are mine. I also know that stories are not fixed and we each have our own and they are continually being written. I just thought that this was such a generous, thoughtful note to add and one that might give solace and inspiration to lots of other writers who are writing their stories. I just wanted to ask how you came to this approach and if this was something that was difficult to get to for you as a writer and as a person.
It's interesting because I don't know a lot about like the sort of like debates around memoir writing. I think maybe it's maybe it's similar to this idea of like social work with whose stories is it to tell?
Yeah.
You know, and that's another one of my anxieties of like, you know, it's not my, like whose right is it to, like I'm not as a professional bound by ethics allowed to talk about the stories of my clients. So these are really kind of fictionalized versions of people that I've worked with. You know, they're kind of composites, you know, that are very similar to, you know, the generic client that a lot of us see. But I guess, yeah, it's interesting, like memoir is about you are dealing with the stories of other people, and I am writing about like there are people in this story who don't know they're in this book, you know, and going to write about people who, you know, and this is the stuff I talked about with my editor. It's like if you don't defame someone you can write about, it's your story, it's happened to you. You know, and it's interesting because I was talking to my family about this because they were sort of asking me about one of the big fractures in my family, which is the last story, which is what happened at my wedding with my parents. How has it been, you know? And how do you, you know, and I was sort of thinking, well, I could complain about this particular thing that happened to me in a private sphere. I can, my friends were there. It was observed by lots of people, but it's a very different thing to then put it on the page, you know, and put it out in the world. And in some ways, I think it's about more than me. It's about this idea of I'm a really privileged trans person who's white, who has money, who has really kind parents, albeit flawed at times. And I still experience things that are really painful. Like it's not just like, you know, and it's funny because like I never thought I'd get married. Like the fact that I got married would have mortified a younger version of me. And I'm sitting with this messy understanding of like, you know what, I'm this really kind of radical person. I got fucking married, man. Like that's cool. Do what makes you happy. But at the same time, I think it's this idea of like, you know what, people can get married, queers can get married, but people still experience these kind of microaggressions within family where they still feel so injured even at almost 40, you know. And so I think it's about more than me. So I think what this offers could offer people is this idea of like it's okay even if you've got a lot of space and a lot of privilege, it can, you know, this life can still be really difficult. And families can be still really hurtful and kind of make mistakes. And I do have some anxiety about putting it in the world. But again, like not putting it in the world would be doing this thing that I always do, which is protecting everyone's feelings. Like my parents were a little nicer to me and they have really done so much to repair with me. And I'm really grateful for that. But as soon as they reached out, and that's what sort of made me write that comment, was like, well, I've been a little bit nicer, so I can't possibly paint them in a bad light. But someone said to me once, like, if you want to be written about well, behave really well. Be a nice person and be responsible for your actions, you know. And so when I've been writing about other people, I've really had this kind of understanding of like be reflective, be curious, be compassionate and see them in their systems.
Particularly the gift and the generosity that is in that story for readers who particularly don't have a lived experience of being queer is being able to see the language system is one of the systems that you're kind of pulling apart and exposing in there that is so painful and so problematic. And the gift that you give in kind of opening that up and saying, here is the pain and here is the problem. It's a really incredible, kind of a generous story in that way as well for your readers. One of the things that I read is that you would have just written a book just so you could write the acknowledgements page, which I love. And your acknowledgements are gorgeous. Tell me, what is it that you love and why is it so important to really open it up to the community who helped you as part of it? Because some people don't like acknowledgements. They don't do them. They don't read them. I want to know what your take is, Erin.
I wonder, do you think that's because people miss out on, they worry about missing out on like someone's
potentially, potentially.
Look, I think this idea of like, I think it's community, right? It's like we are able to do things because there's people around us who enable us to do them. And I'm reading Jenny O'Dell's book about sort of time. I think it's called Saving Time. And it's just really interesting kind of breakdown of time. Like, and she talks about this idea of people don't have, like not everyone has 24 hours in a day, you know, people are employed and there's the employer, and then and usually it's racialized too. It's this idea of like, oh, it's women's work, and so, you know, people don't have this equal amount of time in the day. So I think about, you know, writing is on the backs of, you know, the labor, oftentimes the labor of other people, particularly in a world where you don't pay artists enough money to live. You've got all these other people around you supporting you, or you're having to do another job to do it. So I kind of feel like it's a politicized thing. Writing is this thing that involves so many other systems, you know, if you're lucky enough to have them around. And I think like my life is so full of just really generous people, and I think people have offered me so much, and that's the only reason I've been able to be who I am, you know. It's because I went to therapy, it's because I've got beautiful friends, you know, I've met someone who I can have a healthy relationship with that's given me space to think and dream, you know. Like, it really is so true, like the healing that happens with others. But also I like to not center myself, so I think
this is becoming abundantly clear. So can I ask you what advice you would like to give to the first time podcast listeners?
I think my advice would just be like, have a go, like just have a go at stuff. Like, I feel like if I am, you know, anything to go by, if you have something to say, like just pitch it to a place and like do some writing. And also, I guess the idea of like, you're not, if you don't get kudos for it, doesn't mean you shouldn't keep doing it. Like, if it's fun and you're enjoying it, just keep doing it. But also I think reading a lot, like I just read, I feel like reading has helped my writing in probably an unconscious way, you know. I don't know quite how I've written a book, you know. When I'm sitting in my existential kind of like reflective space, I'm still like, my mind is blown.
Can you please, Erin Riley, recommend to us a debut book, anytime, any genre?
I don't know if that's actually her debut book, but I think it's her debut book of essays. So I'm going to say Fiona Wright's Small Acts of Disappearance. I feel like it really was such a beautiful, like, I think somebody placed it in my hands along with The World Was Whole, which was her second one. But I think that was the first book of essays that just touched me so much, like a personal experience stuff. And maybe also because Fiona's just a beautiful person who offers so much of herself, which I think is just, you know, really nice. You know, kind of like you, Catherine, like you offer so much of yourselves, and I think it's a really generous thing to do for new writers. But yeah, that book really changed how I thought about how you can write a story. Yeah.
It's brilliant, brilliant recommendation. Erin, as I speak to you, you are currently overseas, but I know you will be back for when the book is out in the world. Where should people look for you to find out where they can chat to you or where you're going to be doing events?
Yeah, well, they can basically just find me on Instagram. I've had to make a new one for my writer's profile. It's Erin_J_Riley. I also have to say that the J means nothing. I just decided I'd give myself a middle name. I just actually need to check that is it. Yeah, Erin_J_Riley, R-I-L-E-Y, at Instagram, obviously. But yeah, I'm there. You can write to me. And I have a launch in Sydney on the 25th of July, which is like 6 weeks away, at The Vanguard, which is a beautiful little bar in King Street. And I think there's many tickets left, I'm sure.
Well, that is super exciting. I wish you just the most joyous launch. I can imagine that it will be. And Erin, thank you for this book, for your generosity, and for speaking with us on the First Time Podcast.
Oh, it's so lovely. I'm really grateful. Thank you, Kate. It's been so nice.
Vidya Mardabushi is an Indian writer living in Sydney. She has an MA in creative writing from the University of Sydney, and her first novel, Bystanders, was published in India in 2015. Bystanders was shortlisted for the Tiba Jones South Asia Prize, and a previous version was longlisted for the Australian Vogel Award. In 2018, Vidya received the Writing New South Wales Grant for Fiction for the creation of this novel. The Days Toppled Over is her Australian debut. Welcome, Vidya.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I'm a huge fan of the podcast, although I am a late entry to sort of listening to it, discovering it, and the 2023 debut crew introduced me to the podcast. And since then I've gone back and I'm listening to everything, and it's been a real joy. So thank you for having me.
Oh, I love that. That makes us so happy hearing those, that people have gone back. The first thing I wanted to say is congratulations on the book.
Thank you. Thank you so much. It feels like an enormous achievement, and I'm really proud and excited.
You should be.
Thank you.
It packs a massive, massive punch. It's compelling and it's beautifully written, but it really makes you think. And I think it's a big achievement. So congrats.
Thank you so much. That means a lot.
So tell me, when did you know that you wanted to write this story and how did you begin?
I'm not sure I did know that I wanted to write the story. So it actually began as two separate stories that I was working on simultaneously. So I was working on a story about an international student who was in hospitality, working in a restaurant, trying to sort of, get a PR in Australia. And separately, I was working on another story, which was inspired by an ABC Radio National story that I saw, which was about a young woman who had, suddenly stopped speaking at about the age of 5. And she would speak at home and with her friends, easily, but, she'd stop speaking in any other social setting. And the interview took place when the woman was about 26 years old, and spoke of sort of her journey. And, before then, I'd never heard of selective mutism, this anxiety condition that sort of affects your ability to speak in social settings. And I sort of became very moved by that story, and it stayed with me a long time. So I began another story about, a character who had selective mutism. And I think these two stories of, the international student and the woman with selective mutism sort of were fighting for headspace and intertwined in my head into this Ooh. One book.
So maybe we'll talk a little bit about these two characters in the book. The book, as you sort of suggest, has alternating points of view. We have Marley and Surya, their brother and sister. Surya is an international student in Australia. You mentioned PR. He is seeking PR permanent residency. Tell us, what is his life like?
So, Surya's young. He's come here partly because he's heard that Australia is an exciting place to be. And, in India, there's been a huge push about, what a great place Australia is to study. So he's fallen for some of that messaging. And, he has certain issues that he hasn't fully come to terms with, which, I don't want to spoil, but that, he longs for a sort of escape as well. So he's come to Australia just to have a different kind of life from the one he's experienced previously, but also really looking for adventure, seeking something new and sort of falling for the allure of a new life somewhere else. Mm. But that's certainly his attitude when he comes. But there's quite a difference between what's on paper and reality for someone like Surya, who, he comes here and your rupees don't mean very much when you convert them to dollars. And then he's caught in the system of trying to, earn his keep in the restaurant. He lives above it, along with a whole group of other people in similar circumstances. And you can see how quickly you can fall into the trap of being vulnerable in the system. And that's kind of what happens to him.
Mm. There's a scene where Surya and his colleagues discuss this sort of requisite gratefulness, this idea that you're almost not allowed to be critical or upset about how you are treated while working and living in Australia. It feels very real and it feels clearly very unfair. Tell me a little bit about this expectation on Surya and his friends, and are they able to push back against it?
I mean, I think that, when you come as, and certainly I want to preface this by saying that, I can't speak for other migrants and, there are as many migrants as there are people and, coming to a new country and everybody's journey is unique. But certainly for me, it felt like there was an underlying expectation to this expectation that somewhere you'd left something worse off and you'd come to a better place. And I don't think that's necessarily true for a lot of migrants. It might be for a certain set, but and so, you know, when you come and you find there are faulty things in the system, you're facing prejudice, discrimination, and you speak up against it, there can be this implicit sort of pushback that says, well, then go back. And that's expressed, and it's been expressed to me subtly, but also not so subtly, where, you know, even quite recently, I was telling someone about the book that I'd written and, you know, that I was exposing some of the things that I thought were, you know, not functioning very well in the visa system and what it feels like to be a migrant here. And their first response was, then why are you here? So there is that, you know, and I think like, you know, I've certainly faced it. And this book, especially Surya's part of it, is coming from my own lived experience. And I was, you know, I wanted to explore that space of what it actually feels like. What is the fabric of one's life when you can't be tethered to a place? Because migrants not coming here to play a role. And you might be seen in the news as you're a skilled worker or you're an international student. You're on this particular visa, but that's not how people see themselves. They see themselves as anybody else going, look, you know, I'd like to fall in love and, you know, I'd like a nice place for my kids and I like to feel like I can thrive in my career. So I think that what it feels like when you're here and you have all these visa conditions that thwart you from the things that everybody else can get, it can feel like you're in a hidden world that is in plain sight. Within that hidden world, all you discuss, like when people are meeting up or you're in a taxi or your friends are talking, hey, how did you go? Did you get the, you know, are you jumping from this visa to this visa? Have you found a pathway yet? Have you got sponsorship yet? So it's like very, very actively talking about your visa and how it affects you. But outside, it can feel like nobody else sees that, what it's like that, you know, I can't make plans with my husband if we're on a temporary visa. So I wanted to explore that, like how it actually feels.
It's interesting you say that because I was reflecting after having read the book that I haven't read any books from the point of view of an international student in Australia. I have certainly read articles, but I couldn't even think of one.
Yeah, I think that was one of the motivations for me, really, is that for something that's in the news as much as it is, you know, how often we see it, it's not really reflecting in the literature of this country. And it did feel like there was a place to hear from the perspective of a student. Because, you know, this country relies on international students. And we saw that a lot during the pandemic. And we see it now that, you know, we really want students coming back. But we're not seeing it so much in the literature. So that was something I did want to do.
So that's Surya. Let's talk about Surya's sister, Marley. She has an anxiety disorder. How does it make life difficult?
Well, anxiety makes life very difficult. I mean, in her situation, she's got an anxiety disorder that severely affects her ability to interact with other people because it affects your speech. And so in one sense, it's all pervading because, you know, it affects your schooling, it affects your ability to make friends, it affects what kind of jobs you can apply for, you know, and how people perceive you. So, you know, there is the anxiety of actually living with such a condition, but there's also the anxiety of how people define you and perceive you because of your condition. And I think with Mali, you see that she is so much more than how people perceive her, and that she's, you know, somebody who's vibrant and has like really rich inner life, and, you know, and that she's contributing in ways to the people around her that, you know, are not sort of your normal ways of being successful. So she's, while she can't check off the list of, you know, what are the markers of like society's success, you know, she can't say, I've got a great job, great group of friends, you know, travel, house with a picket fence, none of those things. Yet she's like hugely sort of human and just has so much to give. So I really, really loved writing Mali. And, you know, and I think there's room for expanding our meaning of what it means to be a successful human being. And in some ways, I feel like Mali shows us that.
I agree. From a writing perspective, were there challenges? You said you loved writing Mali, but were there aspects of her voice or how she was difficult in any way?
I think it's a challenge to write about, you know, a condition that you don't yourself have. I think it's a huge responsibility. And so for me, just doing all of the research and just learning about selective mutism, and it's in a very funny twist of fate, you know, I met Elle, who was featured in the ABC Radio National Story, completely unrelated to, you know, anything that I was writing, happened to be on the same Facebook group. She asked a question, I answered, we, you know, got to know each other. And I found out like she was the one who sparked this story. And so it was amazing because Elle ended up being, you know, just a consultant, and she answered all my questions, and, you know, very patiently. And, you know, I just am so grateful for that opportunity, just that sliver of luck that I got to meet her.
How fortuitous.
It was just one of those like amazingly crazy things which happened. So I think like that aspect of Mali, just making sure that, you know, I'm doing the right thing by, you know, people who do have selective mutism. I think that was probably the biggest challenge. I didn't actually find the writing of Mali too challenging. Like I said, it was more the aspect of writing about selective mutism that was challenging. But having a character who has a very sort of vivid inner life, who's bright and funny and smart and, you know, which is offset by how people perceive her, was really fun. So I was able to really get into the mind of Mali and enjoy her. That wasn't a challenge for me.
I'm glad you mentioned the word funny, because it would be easy to think the book was dark, or it explores issues that could be depressing, but there's so much light in this book. It is funny. You've managed this balance of two multiple things very well.
Yeah, thank you. That was really important for me. You know, it is a story, it is fiction, and it's sort of framed like it's a sibling story at heart, framed as a pseudo mystery. But there are a lot of light elements within it, because I don't want readers to, you know, enjoy the story as well. And, you know, of course, it does explore these sort of weighty topics. But I think I'm hoping that readers will, you know, love my underdog characters and want to cheer them on.
Did you, once you had finished the manuscript, how did it come to be published?
So after I finished the manuscript, I basically queried a lot of agents. I think my sort of belief was that the very few publishing houses, and I don't want to burn all my chances, but if I query agents and, you know, they give me some infos, this is working, this is not working, that would be beneficial. So I didn't burn all my chances. So I think that's what I was thinking. So I kind of persevered with trying to get an agent. And it took a long time, I think nearly a year of querying before I found my agent, Rach Crawford, who is just absolutely brilliant. And And once I found her, I went back to working on the book based on her edit letter. So it got a lot better from, you know, what was when I sent it to her. And then from then on, I think it's a blur because once, you know, Rage came into the picture and then we took it to different publishing houses, that happened pretty quickly after that. But it was, you know, 2 years of working on the book, you know, since I started querying.
Now you, Vijaya, had, this is your Australian debut, but you have been published previously in India. Has the process of editing and the kind of the experience of publication been different here as compared with there?
Yeah, again, speaking only for myself, because I've realized that, you know, no two pathways to publication are the same for, you know, writers. That, yeah, for me, it was quite different because I didn't have an agent then. So my book, my manuscript had been shortlisted for an award. And then, you know, I contact with the publisher directly and they, you know, expressed interest in publishing me. And the editing process seemed more fluid and less structured than, say, what I've experienced here. But that might have just been the case for me. So it's very hard to say that's what it's like in India, because it's just so different from, you know, publishing house to publishing house and writer to writer. But yeah, for me, I think it was probably more fluid and this was more structured and with a lot more checks in place in Australia. But that's kind of representative of the life, you know, Indian life versus the Australian life as well. So
it's an interesting point. Vijaya, what is, we have a lot of listeners to the show that are writers, as you know. What is the best or the worst writing advice that you have ever been given?
So the best advice I've received, I think, is don't let your writing be sheep. Rather, let it be an exquisite wild animal, you know, sort of running free. And I think that's because as writers, you know, certainly for me, you can feel all these various pressures of, you know, how am I going to get my book published? But I think it's really important to relish that freedom and love things that are beautiful and crazy and wild. So that would be the advice.
We have never had that advice and I love it.
Thank you. Also, one more. Can I have one more advice?
Yeah, you can have two.
I guess also is to really embrace imperfections in your writing. And for me, I think it shows vulnerability and also the fact that writing is a craft and, it, you know, these are markers of growth. And I've noticed a lot in my reading when I read a piece of writing and I see that, say, a novelist is really valuing, you know, restraint and their, you know, their book is very sort of tight, but in some places they've let go and it's like, it's coming apart and you can see it. And I think that's like incredible. Like, I really appreciate that. Like, you know, there's space between the art and the artifice for some vulnerability, some true sort of humanity to shine through. And, you know, and I think like there's so many imperfections in everything that I've written, but, you know, I've really learned to sort of look at that as markers of my own growth and embrace that.
It's fascinating to see writers that how they experiment along a career too, as a career sort of evolves and refine a particular thing that can be rawer in earlier kind of incarnations.
I think I do that a lot, partly because like my writing career flows in the space left by my other life. Like I, you know, I have a full-time job, I've got kids. So my writing is taking shape around all these other things. And I do see it as long-term, that it's flowing for a very long time and it's going to have all these obstacles and it's going to change in every way, shape, and it's going to be determined by all these things that I'm going through. When I look at it like that, it doesn't really matter that I've written a really terrible poem when I was whatever, or I published this piece that I'm mortified about. you know, it because I see it as flowing, and it helps.
Yeah, the long view. Fitcher, can you recommend a book by a debut author? It can be fiction, nonfiction, from any time, any place, any genre.
Look, I thought about this, you know, because for me, I just can't go past Arundhati Roy's The God of Small Things as, you
is
know,
that
perhaps
first book?
That's her debut.
That. Wow.
Yeah. I mean, I have recently met a few people who have not read it, I guess, because it's not in the news or it's a bit old now, but I was just thinking what a spectacular debut book. And, you know, I read it when I was, you know, just becoming a writer myself, and it had, you know, such an impact on me, and just the newness with which she approaches her writing, and also, you know, a revolutionary in every way, even in her writing. So I really appreciated that. And I think that everybody should read it if they haven't read it.
Required reading.
Required reading.
Final question, Vijay, do you have events coming up? Where can our listeners find you?
Yes. So I do have an event coming up in Collins Bookstore in Thirroul on the 26th of July, 6 p.m. And hopefully I'll have other events coming up, but people can find me on Instagram or Twitter where I'll be announcing them.
Vijay Marabushi, thank you for being on the First Time Podcast.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate being here.
Annette Higgs is a writer living in Sydney, Australia. She was born and grew up in Tasmania, leaving on her 18th birthday to study literature and law at the Australian National University in Canberra. She has lived, worked, and studied in Sydney, London, and Italy, and holds a Doctor of Arts from the University of Sydney. A Pushcart nominee, her short work has appeared in literary journals and anthologies in Australia, the US, the UK, and India. Her novel, On a Bright Hillside in Paradise, won the 2022 Penguin Literary Prize. Welcome to the First Time Podcast, Annette.
Thank you. Thanks, Kate. This is so exciting.
Okay, let's begin, Annette. Can you please give us the pitch for A Bright Hillside in Paradise?
Okay. Well, my novel is about a family of convict descendants living in the back blocks of Tasmania in the 1870s, and what happened when Christian Brethren evangelists came through and held big revivals in the barns and converted everyone and started baptizing them in the streams.
I understand that this is based on some of your own family history and that it was in part written as a creative writing PhD. Can you tell us, Annette, a little bit about the research and the writing process for this book?
Sure. Well, it is indeed based on my family. I mean, it's loosely based, but some of the characters existed and some of them, I've let them keep their real names, which is great. The family in question did live exactly where I put them, under Mount Rowland in the Kentish district. And I'd always known about the Christian Brethren influence in that area around those years, but it was one of those stories from my mother and from local histories that I'd read, and it all just seemed a bit embarrassing, strange. But when it came time to come up with an idea, I finished the Masters of Creative Writing at the University of Sydney, absolutely loved the experience, teachers were fabulous, wanted to keep going, had to come up with a concept, an idea, a project that would keep me interested for the next 3 years to do a doctorate. And immediately popped into my head these people and this time. I feel it must have just been sitting there somewhere in my psyche, being mulled over unconsciously, and out it came. And one thing that really struck me about the whole family story was it was said that one son in the family was an avid convert and another was a skeptic. So the whole family went for it, except for one son. And I thought, there's a story there. There's a story there.
There's so much delicious detail, both in the revivalist meetings, but also very much so in the domestic work of the women, what life is like, how hard it is. Where did you go in terms of archives and that research when you were trying to get this period and those characters right?
In terms of the arrival of the Brethren, there were quite a lot of fascinating research materials once I got into it. There are local histories. I really relied on one particular local history called God Was Their Rock by a local named Alan Dyer, and I've got to give him a shout out because he's in his 80s now, he's in his late 80s, and he gave me a long interview when I first started. And he's a direct descendant of the First Lady who was baptised in the creek. But wow. Apart from that, I learned a lot about 19th century revivalism and how these big tent revivals that were happening in America and England, the revivalists were like the celebrities of the day. And they would have been reported in the newspapers and so on all over the British colonies. But to think that these men came out from England and Ireland and Scotland and went to these back blocks where there were not even any proper roads. I mean, the mindset behind it, the piety, whatever it was that drove them, was, and the reasons that they connected so amazingly with these local people who were often convict descendants and often more or less retreating into the bush to get away from prejudice and build their own homes. That fascinated me. But I'm interested that you mentioned the domestic details too, because a really, really important part of the story for me was framing it around the women of the family. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, these are my family, these are my women, this is where it all comes from. A lot of the details are very true to life, the number of children they had, the number of children they lost, etc. But I just want to emphasise that the title is On a Bright Hillside. And, you know, I really wanted also to bring through a kind of an optimistic tone about it. And I think a big part of it was the way they fell in love with the landscape they found themselves in and embraced it and named it paradise. Mm. So apart from the hardships, which can't be denied, there was an amazing, they got their resilience from somewhere. They got it from their environment as much as their faith, you know.
And the depiction of both the mountain and the forest in paradise is very beautifully done. Did you spend time there, Annette, as part of your research?
Absolutely. In fact, I've just now been posting pictures of myself climbing Mount Roland on Instagram. Very important psychogeographical research. But no, my grandparents lived under that mountain their whole lives, and my mother was born there. And I often went back to that area as a child and also as an adult, and I still go back. And anyone who's spent time under that mountain talks about its aura. It's a very spiritual place. It's amazing.
As we said in the bio, you won the 2022 Penguin Literary Prize. I know that our first-time listeners are always so interested to know how work gets submitted, whether it was the first lucky submission and you won from there, or whether there'd been a long history of submitting work. So can you tell us about the path to publication for this book, Annette?
Sure. Well, when I was doing my Masters of Creative Writing, the idea of submitting short work to literary journals and so on was, you know, discussed a lot, and I went for it. And you might have heard the saying that you should aim for 100 rejections.
Indeed.
And I've got them.
Congratulations.
Yeah, and I mean, it's not 100 different pieces of work, but the same work rejected multiple times. I mean, you have to go back and hone and think about what editors want, and you learn a lot in the process. But also, after getting all those rejections, I also ended up with, you know, 16 or 18 actual acceptances. And the thrill of those moments just can't be described when you're a new writer. And you can do it, you know, just hone your work and submit it. That's the key. But when it came to longer work, to novels, you know, there's less opportunity to submit your stuff. I mean, you can directly approach agents and also some publishers and so on. When I finished my work, and I've got to say that 3 years writing it, which was the COVID years, really. And, you know, I was writing it because the subject matter just was so close to my heart. But I didn't think anybody would want to read white settler fiction in Australia today. You know, this was a really serious thing for me. And, you know, I really thought, I said to my supervisor, I said, nobody is going to read this except you because you're paid to, you know, nobody is going to want to read this. But because I'd been trained up properly to submit, when I finished and had submitted it for the degree and was waiting for examination, which is another whole thing, you get a lot of good feedback, I've got to say, and thanks to my examiners for that. But I decided I would keep on with the submitting thing, and I submitted the manuscript to a couple of unpublished manuscript prizes. And that was, you know, fairly early on when it was new, and amazingly shortlisted for the Penguin Literary Prize. And that shortlisting, I think it was even a bigger moment than the win. It was such validation, the validation from somebody reading it and liking it and appreciating it enough to give it that tick. You know, so all power to the Penguin Literary Prize judges of 2022, because they changed my life. You know, they changed my life.
That's really interesting. A couple of things you mentioned there. First, I'll go to the editing and the feedback process, because that is an extraordinary thing that you get as part of your doctorate and doing that submission there. Mm. How did the editing then move into a different phase once you were signed with Penguin and knew that this was going to become a book? What kind of shift was there in terms of the editing for the novel?
Well, during the writing process, I must have written about 4 or 5 completely different drafts, like structured completely differently, different points of views, different characters. There's a lot of stuff on the cutting room floor, let me tell you. And a lot of that was really major project guidance, both from the point of view of research, what I needed to pursue in that vein, and also structure. One of my examiners was Belinda Castles, who's an award-winning novelist herself. And she's like, no, don't go there. Yeah, you've got to do this. It was very kind of universal. It was terrific. It was a big hug of guidance is what it was. And then once it went to the Penguin judges, I got some structural feedback. And I thought I was just having lunch and talking about it. When it got to the end of lunch, I said, so what's the next step? And the publisher said, well, the next step is you go away and rewrite it. So, yes, I did that. And it wasn't huge. It was develop this character more, fix up this little bit, watch your timeline. It wasn't hugely drastic changes. And it was encouraging. It was great. And I did that. And then the copy edit was an entirely different process again. And that was really sentence level stuff. So, yeah.
And the other thing you mentioned in there was your fear that the book would never be read by anyone or published, particularly because of this approach from it being white settler history. And we know that this is really difficult territory, especially as a non-Indigenous writer, to write within the context of First Nations history and dispossession. Mm. How did you approach this and what did you take into account when writing the novel?
It's probably one of the most important questions that I had to face as a researcher and a writer. And I went to a lot of faculty seminars on the subject. I followed podcasts and presentations by Indigenous writers all through those years. I consulted with Indigenous writers in the faculty. I was very, very, I was as careful as I could be. And at the end of the day, I remember sitting in one seminar where somebody said, I don't think you can write this stuff today. And I just put my head on the desk. But, you know, my people were there. They were who they were. And I just wanted to tell their story. But I do know, you know, there were Indigenous people in the community, in the end, wrote some Indigenous characters. And I tried my best to do what you should do as a white writer, which is do your research, do your thinking, don't write stereotypes, don't write from their point of view, because how can you know? And so my characters are part of the community. They're not central characters in the novel, but they're there because they were there.
Structurally, the book circles some key events, and it does this from different members of the community and their point of view. When did you arrive at this particular shape, and what kinds of difficulties or opportunities did it present you? Because it's a very particular way of circling the story.
Yeah, I call it a starburst, you know.
Oh, nice.
It had a lot of, I'd done a lot of writing before I got to it, put it that way, like probably a couple of years of writing. And the structure wasn't correct and I was throwing bits away. And I can remember the moment walking in my suburb up the hill carrying the groceries, and I can remember the exact spot on the footpath where I had this idea that the way to do it would be to start with the thing that was the central event of the novel that impacted everybody, and that was the revival in the barn, the big revival on the hill. So I decided to start from there. And then that event affected these five different people in five different ways. And I started to set up all that I had in that structure. And it actually worked out really well because I realized as I started to do it that one person never knows not only what another person is thinking, but sometimes not even what happened to them or what they did. And I start with the old lady and no one tells her anything. So she has her own experience, but she only has half the story. And this is true of everybody. And it's true in life, I think. Mm. And I really sort of settled into that structure because I thought it reflected the way things are.
What are you most looking forward to when this book gets out in the world? And perhaps what are you nervous about?
Well, I'm nervous about everything.
That's very normal.
You know, what I'm really looking forward to the most, and the launch, obviously, because, you know, the friends and fam, et cetera, but I'm looking forward to taking it down to Tasmania and particularly as close as I can get it to Mount Roland and Sheffield and where the book is set, because it's written for those people, you know. So the Penguin rep in Tasmania has been a real sweetheart, and she's really behind the book, and she's out there telling the booksellers she really is Tasmanian. Come on. And so I'm going to go down there and talk to Tasmanian people about this Tasmanian book. And it sounds a little parochial, and I don't want to give the impression that the book isn't, you know, doesn't hopefully have universal themes as well, but I am looking forward to that.
Annette, can you please share with our first-time podcast listeners some writing advice perhaps that you've picked up along the way in the writing of this novel?
Sure. Well, I've got to say the first thing that occurs to me is to say don't forget that after you've written something, don't forget to submit it. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of writers will tell you this. A lot of people work very hard on it and they go back and hone and ask advice about the writing, but you've got to submit. So do that, because I wouldn't be where I was today if I hadn't just done that. But I think the other thing is, you know, don't think too much about who will or won't want to read it. Just write what you really want to write, because I think that intensity comes through somehow in your writing and makes the whole story sing. Mm.
Annette, can you please give us a debut book recommendation, any time or any genre?
Okay, now I'm going to do what is probably going to sound like cross promotion here, but I'm really sincere about it. I'm going to highly recommend the 2021 Penguin Literary Prize winner, who was James Mackenzie Watson, and his novel is called Denizen, and it's absolutely fabulous. I've got to say, it's not a genre I would have picked up if it hadn't been the winner, but I was so impressed with it. And it's a story of a little boy in rural New South Wales, and also him as a man who he goes back to his hometown and he has to face various ghosts. And it's really hard hitting, and it's complex in its structure. And it also has some fabulous lyrical, just the way language is used to help you live inside this troubled young man. I'm so impressed by it. Denizen, James Mackenzie Watson.
Loved it here as well. Incredible book. And we're also huge fans of James and Ashley Collegium Blunt's podcast, James and Ashley Stay at Home. Terrific, terrific recommendation. Annette, we're excited for you for this book coming out into the world on a bright hillside in paradise. Where can people find you so that they know where you'll be, perhaps visiting Tasmania, and how they can meet you and read the book?
Sure. Everything will be on my website, which is ahiggswriter.com, and on Instagram at Bright Hillside.
Fantastic. Yes. Where we can see the pictures of you climbing that mountain.
Absolutely.
Annette, thank you so much for joining us, and good luck with the publication of On a Bright Hillside in Paradise, and enjoy when you get down to Tasmania and you get that as close as you can to the mountain.
Thanks, Kay. Thank you so much for your support and interest. It's been terrific.
Nick Bessine is a writer and editor based in Sydney, but originally from the US. His writing has appeared in a variety of publications, including The New York Times, The Guardian, The Sydney Morning Herald, The Age, Junkie, and McSweeney's. And he has occasionally appeared on ABC Melbourne Radio as a cultural attaché. He won the US game show Name That Tune, and his satirical parenting blog, Daddy's Little Miracle, was selected to join the New York Times parenting section's blog role. Nick has worked as an editor for Junkie, 10 Daily, SBS, Foxtel Magazine, and OK Magazine. He has a tremendous speaking voice. Welcome, Nick.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.
Oh, can confirm, speaking voice, tremendous.
It's not me saying it. Other people have said it.
Yeah, that's right. Well, first up, I didn't say this off air because I like saying it on air. Congrats on the book. It is so clever and so funny. And I wanted to steal so many sentences from it and pretend that I wrote them.
You're very kind. Thank you very much.
Would you be opposed to that idea?
No, this, as we all know, once a writer writes, the words are for the public to use as they will.
I love it. When did you know that you wanted to write this story, and how did you begin?
I've wanted to write it since, for 20 years. I, like a lot of debut novels, it's semi-autobiographical. I went through some similar things. I was living in LA when my mother died very suddenly, and I had a very tough time, and that was back in 2002. So ever since then, I've been wanting to figure out how I could write this story while making it very entertaining and funny.
Well, you've absolutely succeeded. I had a question about how much was inspired by your own experiences, because it very much feels like an inside job.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, feels a little bit like a cliche, because I think a lot of people do that. But I mean, I don't know. Here I am. I don't know what to do about it. I wanted to write about something I'd gone through personally.
Well, it's kind of that write what you know too, isn't it? Like,
it is a bit, yeah.
You have a particular experience. As you said, the book is set 2002, 20 years ago now. Obviously, you lived through aspects of it, or you were in this particular time and place. But what was the process of remembering either events or that time period?
Luckily, while I was going through my own emotional crisis, which inspired the emotional crisis in I Look Forward to Hearing From You, I was taking notes the whole time about what I was doing, the sometimes unsavory ways I was behaving because of being on antidepressants, which didn't agree with me at the time. And so since then I've been remembering things and taking notes. And so I had all this huge backlog of notes, but also with the pop cultural stuff, I remembered going to certain concerts, watching certain movies, being into certain TV shows, but I did have to go back and research and remember, low-rise jeans were extremely popular at that time. There was a lot of that. The book is filled with those kinds of pop cultural references. Yeah.
Mm. Hector, the main character in this book, is this beautiful combination of being sort of moderately talented, but extremely confident. Mm. And we have this gorgeous experience as a reader of seeing what he is thinking and why he's behaving a certain way. But you also get the, you can read into how everybody else in this scene is perceiving him, and that those two perceptions are not really in sync. Do you think there's a particular type of scene that a character like Hector thrives in?
I think for me, the best kind of scene would be where there is something very normal or banal going on. A group of friends getting together for a drink, or in the book, there's a poker scene.
Oh my God.
And
you just want to cover your eyes with the poker scene.
Yes. So for me, the funniest setup is when life is just going on as normal, but somebody is clearly having a hard time and it is coming out in not normal ways that society is not prepared to deal with, much less just friends trying to play poker, for example. And so, I mean, those kinds of scenes were my favorite to write. They're my favorite. They're still my favorite to read. I still think they're funny. And So it's when people expect everyone to play a certain role. Like, we're just playing poker here. We're just playing cards. Everybody be normal. But somebody is having a hard time and he can't be normal. And I think that's where it works best.
I love that. And so when you are putting scenes together, do you plot meticulously or are you a pantser? Do you write?
I'm a plotter. Pants?
Yeah, okay.
I'm a plotter. The pantsers, I feel like they're on another planet as far as I'm concerned. I don't know how they do it. I have to plot very carefully. I have to know where I'm going. And I know even within a structure, I still find the art, you know, I still find the magic because I do get into a zone and a flow where things go in different directions. But I've written a lot of screenplays also, which is much more structured and things have to happen at a certain time, but that's just in terms of an overall structure. But I've found that just helps me get to from point A to point B, I guess. Yeah.
So how detailed is the planning?
Well, it's extremely detailed. I use Scrivener.
Yeah, I love that. Scrivener.
It's very helpful for organization of scenes and chapters. And I just find that I wanted to write something very entertaining. And I was inspired by using film structure to keep things moving and to make sure that, because my first draft was something like 700 pages. And it required a lot, your eyes just, yeah. Yeah, it was a beast. And I had to pare it down quite a bit. And so it helped to know that, okay, at this point, the character, I don't know how often novelists use these kinds of terms, but here's where the inciting incident has to be. Mm. So if it's been 300 pages and that hasn't happened, I know there's a problem.
Mm. That's interesting. So we know a little bit about where the kind of idea of the book began. We know a little bit about the writing process, but how did it come to be published?
So I was working at a website when the pandemic hit and the website was shut down. I was an editor. And then I just thought I've been writing this book for years. I haven't been able to finish it because I've been working full time. So I'm going to take some time to finish the book, write every day on a schedule that I hadn't been able to do since I was working full time. And it felt like the world was falling apart. It felt like a good time to stay inside and just write. So I did that. And then I ran out of money. And then I won a bunch of money on that game show.
Oh, you're kidding.
Yeah. And that allowed me to finish the book. And I knew an editor at Penguin Random House and I sent it to her and she listened to it.
Oh my God, that feels like the kind of thing you have a vision board and then the universe like finds a way for you to, or you just, the game show is named that tune. You just know a lot of tunes.
Well, as it turns out, I do. I didn't think of myself as a trivia person beforehand, but I studied. It was an unbelievably intense experience being up there and having to just listen to 3 seconds of a song and you have to guess it. It was tough. And I don't think of myself as the kind of person who gets lucky like that. You know, that those kinds of things don't normally happen to me, but I happened to see the call out on Twitter because a friend tagged me in it. And I auditioned and I went on and I won.
Yeah, right.
And then I was able to finish the book.
What a great moment.
Yeah, it was something.
So, Nick, Hector is a very funny character. The book is very funny, but there's also a lot, which you've sort of alluded to already, that is not that funny. And I mean, things are very entertaining, but there's a real sting in the tale. And so racism would be a really major theme throughout the book, diet culture, grief, and the death of Hector's mother and really his kind of difficulty in dealing with that. I'm really interested in humor when it's coupled with another emotion. And I think within Hector, you sort of see this sadness that comes through. I'm wondering if that's a conscious process for you, if you have a view on how humor works and and what is too much funny, what things bring it down, and how much you kind of thought about balancing humor?
So humor was the top priority for me. I favor humor in my writing. I tend to write funny stuff. And so I was confident that I could make it funny, but I also wanted it to be real. And the stuff that makes me laugh the hardest, the stuff that I like the most, is humor that comes from a deep discomfort, a deep emotional place where something awful is happening at the same time. I mean, I have a kind of a silly, weird sense of humor, and generally, but the stuff that, but when that is rooted in, like you were saying, like the grief, body dysmorphia, all like mental health, serious stuff, that makes it, that can make it even funnier, which is a weird way to think about it. But I think when I was putting the book together, I wanted to, my first priority was, this person is out of control and he is going through a lot of horrible stuff. I wasn't sure people would be along for the ride if it wasn't funny, because as important as it is to explore all these issues, it just felt like, well, this guy is a bit much, you know, this is a bit of a slog. And I thought that's what would make the book stand out also, as if while it was going through all of, exploring all of that, all those issues, if it was still funny, like that would be an achievement for me. That's what I was really hoping for. And I think that by going back and forth between some of the very sincere, authentic, emotional stuff, finding the humor in the crisis, I hope I've achieved that balance of something very serious and real, but also entertaining, fast moving and funny.
It feels like there's just a lot of social criticism in there too. Listening to some of the scenes with writers or Hector in a writer's room, and what goes on, particularly with regard to race, is deeply uncomfortable. I think that's the right word for it.
Yes. I think sometimes I wonder, you know, that when you look at where we were 20 years ago, culturally, I don't know, 20 years ago, it sounds like a long time, but if you look at movies and things from back then, and it's still stuff that people enjoy today, but we were just much more casual about certain things that obviously now, you know, we certainly would not be. But I just thought it was interesting to reflect back on 20 years ago from a 2023 perspective, and how different everything was, and how different things are today. I just have a constant appreciation for that, and I think about it a lot. So I wanted that reflected in the way people talk about race, the way people talk about diet culture, and mental health. Like literally, people were calling antidepressants crazy pills. You know, you wouldn't be so dismissive about things like that now. So, yeah, that was important to me.
The weight diet culture is quite striking too. Just even hearing about Hector's experience with something like Weight Watchers, which has fallen out of vogue a lot, and some of their public weigh-ins and things like that, just feels so insensitive.
Yeah, I mean, it was just incredible how the journey that Weight Watchers has been on. I mean, it was a staple, like that and Jenny Craig. I don't know if you had Jenny Craig here. It was in the US.
We did.
And the way they talked about it, the way they got people to sign up. And I mean, there's been more, a closer scientific examination on how people lose weight and how most people when they lose a lot of weight, they don't keep it off for a variety of reasons. And so it's very different. And, but for somebody of my generation, I feel like a lot of that stuff sticks around. And so I wanted to explore that a little bit in a way, because like all the body positivity and body acceptance that happens now, it just, it feels too hard, too complicated to me. I can't get my head around it. And I think it's good. I think it's, God, I mean, I wish it was around 20 years ago. But yeah, there's just a constant conflict between this new idea of rejecting diet culture, but the stuff that is so ingrained in me from that time. I don't know if that,
Well, I think that would be a tension that exists for a lot of, for many of us, you know, probably around at the same time. I want to talk to, there is this thing that you do at the beginning of each chapter. You have added in quotes from famous people. Sometimes I skim quotes when I read books because I feel like what they mean to the reader and the author aren't always the same thing. Yes. I absolutely love each and every one of these quotes. How do they work for you? What do they mean to you?
Well, they work on a few levels. I included them for a few reasons. So when you're talking about epigraphs, those quotes at the beginning, they can mean anything to anyone. And sometimes, oh, that's a really interesting quote. I wonder what it meant to the author. And that makes me more curious about what I'm about to read. And sometimes I'll think, okay, you're leaning on some very famous person's intense, wonderful quote. And now we're going to start reading your words. I don't know. And so there was that. I'm fascinated by that. And then also just the way we not worship, but there are certain quotes from celebrities and famous people that we take very seriously, and people will live by them, which is fine and it makes sense. You know, these are successful people, but I just find it hilarious to think of quotes from celebrities that don't make a whole lot of sense, or great artists that don't make a whole lot of sense, but a lot of people take them very seriously. And so I wanted to make up quotes that were extremely over the top, but still related to what was going on.
Are they made up?
They're all made up, yeah.
Are they really?
Yeah.
Right. Okay. Because I was like, I can't believe Meg Ryan said that. Okay. That makes so much sense. Okay.
I mean,
I just thought you were incredible at finding these crazy things that famous people had said. No.
I wish. I made them all up because I wanted it to relate to what was going on in the book, but I also wanted it to be totally over the top and insane.
That's even better. That makes me like them even more.
And I wanted them to sound like it's something they would have said in an interview with Vanity Fair or something like that.
Yeah. Mission accomplished.
I mean, it's amazing that I didn't even, you know, when Penguin Random House was, when people were reading the book, a lot of people weren't sure if it was real or not. And I thought they were so over the top. There's no way people are going to think these are real.
Well, never know. There's sometimes great delight as a reader, I think, in reading things that are super unexpectedly funny. Your acknowledgements, I would say, are one of the best acknowledgements. It would feel silly to recommend to readers to, if they find the book and only read part of it, to read your acknowledgements, but they're definitely worth a read.
Thank you very much. I did a bunch of research about acknowledgements and what people write and different ways they go about it. Because I wanted mine to fit the book and be entertaining, but also I really wanted to thank some people. So I had a lot of fun with that, definitely.
We won't reveal what the acknowledgements are because I do want people to read them, but that fitting the book, chef's kiss, yeah, very in keeping. Nick,
yeah.
We have a lot of listeners to the show that are writers. What is either the best or conversely the worst advice you have for other writers?
First is win money on a game show. That is crucial to finishing a novel, or any big project, really. So my advice is, there's a bunch of things that I live by. A novel is so long, and it takes so long to write. I'm sure lots of people have said this before. You have to really love the process. You have to wake up and just have a great time writing this book. And I know a lot of people say it's painful, you know, to sit there for hours and write, and, you know, it weighs on you. And but yeah, I think you have to enjoy that stuff on some level, because otherwise it'll be impossible to finish. If it's a slog, if your heart's not in it, if you're not that invested in them, I think that's going to make it very, very hard. So that's a big piece of advice. It's a big thing that got me through writing this book, because whatever happened with it, whether it was published or not, I wanted to do it. Mm-hmm. I wanted to have a completed book at the end of it. And that's how I got through. And the other thing is that, and I got this from, and lots of people have ripped it off since, William Goldman, who's a famous screenwriter, who said that nobody knows anything. And he was talking about Hollywood, but I think the same thing could be said for book publishing. People are, they're trying to engage with the writing that they, that's coming across their desk, and while trying to anticipate the market in some way, but nobody really knows. And as that antitrust trial in the US showed us, there's a lot of people are just trying things out. And so I think you should just go for it. You know what I mean? Like, don't worry too much about that side of things.
I think that's great good advice.
Yeah.
Final question, Nick. Can you recommend a book by a debut author from any time, any place, any year?
Yeah. So as a longtime listener, first-time caller to your podcast, I was familiar with this question. And I don't have it with me right here. But I wanted to recommend Really Good Actually by Monica. I'm not 100% sure how to pronounce her last name. I believe it's Heisey, H-E-I-S-E-Y.
I love that.
It's very funny. I think she's got a great voice, and it's very entertaining. And I'm always on the lookout for funny books. I feel like there aren't. I don't see that many of them. So I get excited when I find one.
Good recommendation. Thank you, Nick, for being on the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
You can find the show notes for today's episode on our website, thefirsttimepodcast.com. Get in touch with us via Instagram or Twitter at @thefirsttimepod, or you can leave us a message on the website. Thanks for listening. You've been listening to The First Time Podcast. We record this podcast virtually on the unceded lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. We pay our respects to elders, past and present, and we extend that to our First Nations guests and listeners. Sound production by Phoebe 80, who we can employ because of the wonderful support of our patrons via Patreon. Thank you so much for making this podcast possible.